Okay, we're going to get started. And for those of you who are not here first thing this morning, unfortunately, Professor Mendelson cannot be with us in person, and she has sent a video recording and is going to be calling in, or is actually on the line now, and is hopefully going to participate in any Q&A and also in commenting on what her commenters say about her article. This has been a very unusual conference in terms of having last-minute surprises, and last night we found out that Ms. Tseng could not join us. So, this is your panel, and luckily it's a wonderful panel, and I do think Professor Mendelson will be able to participate. So thank you for joining us. We're going to try to catch up a little bit on time, and I'm going to hand it over to Philip to introduce our panel.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Philip Liu, and I'm an articles editor with the Vanderbilt School of Environmental Law and Policy Annual Review. This panel is on Professor Nina Mendelson's article, Private Control Over Access to the Law, The Perplexing Federal Regulatory Use of Private Standards. I'll just take a few minutes to present some information on our panelists. Nina Mendelson is the Joseph L. Sachs Collegiate Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School. She teaches and conducts research on administrative law, environmental law, statutory interpretation, and the legislative process. Before joining Michigan Law School, Professor Mendelson served for several years as an attorney with the United States Department of Justice's Department of Environmental and Natural Resources Division. She earned her AB in economics from Harvard University and her Juris Doctorate from Yale. Our first panelist is Lois Schiffer, and she is the General Counsel for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA. As General Counsel, she leads more than 116 attorneys. She has also been an adjunct professor of environmental law at Georgetown University Law Center. And prior to working at the NOAA, she worked as an assistant attorney general. She received her undergraduate degree from Radcliffe College and her law degree from Harvard Law School. To her left is Emily Bremer, and she is the Senior Attorney and Research Coordinator for the Administrative Conference of the United States, or the ACUS. Prior to this, she clerked on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in Alaska. Ms. Bremer received her BA from NYU and also her law degree from NYU as well. She will be working as a professor at the University of Wyoming starting in the fall.
Referred to as IBR rules. The federal regulation says, we hereby ask you to comply with, say, standard Z245, please contact the organization for the text of the standard. Unlike the rest of the federal statutes and regulations, they are not available online for free. Unlike the rest of federal statutes and regulations, they're not available in our over 1,100 government depository libraries. Instead, again, the public is referred to the private organization. Standards can be very hard to locate since they are strewn across hundreds of privately operated websites. And even once you find the standard you're looking for, the organization is permitted to set any price it wishes for access. The prices range widely. The infant swing standard is a comparative bargain at $51, while the reported average for pipeline safety standards is $150 per rule. For small businesses and individuals, or anyone who needs to read multiple standards, the price can be prohibitive. The only other alternative is to travel to Washington, D.C., and to visit an agency reading room, usually the Office of the Federal Register. In the last year or so, there has been improvement. Some private organizations, like the American Petroleum Institute, have made their IBR standards available on a free read-only basis in private online reading rooms. This is an improvement, but it is not sufficient public access. The standards remain hard to find, and free access, even when it is provided, is erratic. Further, to get to see the standards in these online reading rooms, a reader has to agree to all kinds of conditions, even a promise to indemnify the organization. Meanwhile, the organizations consistently reserve the right to revoke that free access at any time or for any reason. And many standards are simply unavailable this way. Some organizations do not provide free access at all, or particular standards are not posted. Some standards identified as the law by a federal agency are out of print altogether and cannot be purchased for any price. The state of affairs is stunning. How did we get to a place where there is not meaningful free access to thousands of our binding regulations, or where some of this law has disappeared altogether? We have a problem when significant regulatory law is effectively under private control. What I want to do with my remaining time is talk about why this problem matters and make some preliminary suggestions about what we might do about it. First, it of course matters to those who must comply with these standards. They need notice. Regulated entities, such as petroleum companies, may already be members of the drafting organization. That probably comes with access to the standards. But small businesses may not. Architects and operators of small trucking companies wrote the Office of the Federal Register about how they could not afford to buy standards that affected them. Second, ordinary citizens need to be able to learn what the law says as well. People who live near an oil pipeline, like the one in Michigan running under the Straits of Mackinac of the Great Lakes, need to be able to learn not only whether there are standards for pipeline operation, but what those standards say. That can help them to decide where to live and what emergency plans they need to make. Parents who buy toys or infant swings need to be able to learn what safety standards those products must comply with. People who drink tap water need to be able to see how drinking water standards are implemented to decide whether to filter their water. It should go without saying that Congress enacted laws like the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Pipeline Safety Act, and the Consumer Product Safety Act to provide important protections to the public. The public has a stake in being able to learn the details of how these laws are implemented. Finally, if transparency in government means anything, it has to mean the law. Ordinary citizens need to know what is in government regulations to hold agencies accountable for the decisions they are making. Private organizations may have a lot of expertise, but their responsibility is not the same as an agency. They have no obligation to carry out federal statutes or to devise safety standards that, say, serve the public interest. Meanwhile, it is federal policy to try to use private standards, and agencies can save significant resources if they do not have to draft standards themselves. Thus, agency officials may be overly tempted to use private standards even when they are less than ideal from the standpoint of the public interest. That's under the best of circumstances. Under the worst of circumstances, if an agency is captured by the entity it regulates, there is an even greater risk that the private standards it selects may not be good ones. How can the public hold the government accountable for these decisions? Citizens may wish to to cast an informed vote, to write their senator, to write comments in an agency rulemaking, or to ask an agency to revise a standard. Citizens may also wish to file a lawsuit challenging an agency rule. All of these means of holding the government accountable are undermined when citizens lack meaningful access to the text of the regulatory standards themselves. Some might say that the cost of buying a standard pales in comparison to the cost of, say, filing a lawsuit. This may or may not be true, but writing an agency or your senator or deciding which products to buy or where to live or what emergency plans to make, these are not necessarily costly decisions. The difficulty of finding IVR standards and the price required to read them thus serve as distinct obstacles to citizens exercising their legal rights. In short, letting private entities control access to IVR standards and charge for it undermines the public's ability to hold government accountable for the decisions that it makes. It also sends a damaging message when the government decides to regulate by incorporating expensive and difficult to locate standards. Since 1795, we've had an American tradition of widespread public access to the law. But when agencies use IVR rules, our law appears to be under private control. Moreover, charging for access to something as fundamental as the text of the law, or requiring travel to Washington, D.C. to see it, underscores a message that the government is more accessible to, and thus could be more responsive to, the wealthy and corporations. What might we do about this? People have suggested some possibilities. Agencies might negotiate with private organizations for a meaningful level of public access before they incorporate a standard, or they might contract with drafting organizations for the standards. If such negotiation isn't possible, an agency may be faced with the choice to draft its own standards. Whatever the arrangement, a bedrock condition must be meaningful levels of public access without charge. Access in the government depository libraries would be a significant improvement, although even that would be a step down from the free online access we have come to rely upon for the rest of our federal statutes and regulations. Meaningful levels of free public access aren't just important, they are also legally required. The Freedom of Information Act requires that IVR material be, quote, reasonably available to the class of persons affected, unquote. For the affected people we are talking about, the concept of reasonable availability has to include significant levels of easy-to-find access without charge. I want to close by emphasizing federal regulatory actions are some of the most significant powers the federal government exercises. These actions broadly define rights and obligations across the entire public. Access to the text of these rules cannot just be a formality. Under our current system, people affected by regulatory standards, those who must comply, as well as neighbors, consumers, employees, and ordinary citizens, cannot learn the substance of the rules without a possible charge of hundreds of dollars to a private organization, or else having to travel to Washington, D.C. This is not a tenable state of affairs. The text of all of our regulations, this binding law, has to be readily and meaningfully available to the public. That has to include significant levels of access without charge. Thank you, and I look forward to hearing your comments. First, thank you for the invitation to present today, and also for letting me participate remotely. Thank you as well to the very distinguished commenters.
I would be pleased to. So I'm Lois Schiffer. In my current work job, I'm general counsel at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. What is this?
That's Nina.
Oh, hi, Nina. You look like a little black box here. It's quite funny. But I need to hasten to add, I'm speaking for myself only and not for NOAA and not for the Commerce Department, of which it's a part. I am very happy to have the opportunity to comment on Nina's article, partly because Nina worked with me at the Justice Department before she went on to her distinguished academic career, and secondly, because I think this is an extremely important article. I am here to say that although I have been around federal regulation and environmental law for, at this point, over 40 years, I had not really been aware of the incorporation by reference issue until I read Nina's really important article. I will add that I was aware in late last fall when the government promulgated a new incorporation by reference regulation, and I brought it down to my office and said, here's the new regulation, send it around, be sure people comply if it comes up. Turns out it doesn't come up at NOAA, which is one of the reasons I don't know much about it. But the idea that the government has a body of law that the public can't get to free is quite startling to those of us who've spent a lot of time working on public participation in rulemaking, enforceability of rules. You need to know what the rule is in order to make it enforceable. Government transparency, the importance of public access through the Freedom of Information Act, and just basic due process and fairness. And so I think that I am in complete agreement with Nina that, but I may go farther than she does, that it's important for the government, if it's going to use privately developed standards as part of its rules, to be sure that the public can see those rules, can participate in those rules. I would add that the government ought to make it a component of its use of those standards and reliance on those standards, that the standard developing entity make enough of a record that when the rule gets in, that when the standard gets incorporated into a rule, in order to have meaningful public comment, there's an opportunity for people to see what it is. So I can certainly understand that the tensile strength of a pipe might not be something that is riveting to everybody, but somebody is making some assumptions somewhere about the, how protective it's going to be, the nature of that strength, how much, what kind of testing it needs to go through. And if somebody who wants to understand what's going on, comment on the regulation or be bound, comment on the draft regulation or be bound by the regulation, doesn't have free access to that standard and what underlies it, I don't know how that commenting is meaningful. I will say one thing that I'm a little surprised at is that there hasn't been more challenge to this process, and I didn't come to it with a lot of knowledge, but Nina's thoughtful article doesn't seem to suggest there's been endless litigation over these matters. Now, what are some remedies? I have one little glimmer of hope. In a different context, in February 2013, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is essentially the science office inside the White House, came out with a policy, and it builds on something called the U.S. Open Data Policy, and the 2013 OSTP policy talks about increasing a public access to federal research results. And the general idea is if federal money paid for this research and these research results, the public ought to have access to it. And preferably, though I won't say absolutely, but preferably free. And agencies are expected to develop policies, to develop their own policies. NOAA has a policy. And while I will certainly spare you every detail of the policy, I want to give you a little bit of an indication. The core principles in the NOAA policy include publications and environmental data funded through taxpayer dollars will be made publicly accessible in a timely fashion. Secondly, in the case of articles published by limited access journals, and those are journals which in some ways are similarly situated to the kinds of entities that Nina's article talks about, that is, they make their money on the fact that people have to pay for them, and that's what keeps them going, and it's probably in all of our interest to keep them going. There will be a look at what are the ways that that information can be made available for free, and it may include embargoing so the journal gets the first 12 months and then the articles are publicly available, or other methods yet to be developed and being thought about, but there's thinking out there. I raise this public access to research results as an analog because I think that it makes very clear that when government activity is using material that the public really needs to have access to, it's beginning to think about and figure out ways to make that happen. And I think Nina Your article highlights the importance of similar arrangements, not because taxpayer dollars are at stake, but because an even more crucial principle, fundamental fairness and constitutional due process, are at stake in figuring out ways to be sure that the public has free and quick and available access, and whether that is the government paying the licensing fee to the private entity so that the material is available, or other means, it should be worked on. But the idea that somehow I'm required to comply with the law, but I can't see what the law is, goes against every concept of due process that we have. So I'm very glad that you wrote this article and highlighted this problem. I think it underscores really a fundamental issue that you are ventilating, and I am happy to have had the chance to have the chance to comment on it and discuss it further.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, and to comment on this in this article. I should also begin with a disclaimer that my views are my views alone and do not necessarily represent the views of the Administrative Conference of the United States or its committees or its members. That actually might be more self-evident in this instance than it is ordinarily. In fact, Professor Mendelson is a public member of the Administrative Conference, and I believe this article was written perhaps in response to a recommendation that the Administrative Conference issued or adopted in 2011. That was recommendation 2011-5 on incorporation by reference. I served as the Administrative Conference's in-house researcher on that project. When I started it, I didn't know it had anything to do with standards, actually, and people kept telling me, oh, you could make a whole career out of standards, to which I would respond, oh, God, no. And now I'm just starting my fourth article on standards. So, and I'm going to be referring to also a follow-up study that I did in sort of my spare time on incorporated standards in the pipeline safety context. Now, one of the interesting things, I think Professor Mendelson has really done a great service by producing such a robust and thorough analysis of the reasons why we need to have free and ready access to these private materials that are made part of our law, both at the proposed rule stage and also at the final rule stage. An interesting point, I think, is that I'm completely in agreement with that, and the Administrative Conference's recommendation indeed embraces the idea that the ideal public policy goal here is to get to a place where the public has free online access to these materials. Where the conference's recommendation and my own views diverge from Professor Mendelson's, I think, is in identifying what an acceptable and workable solution is to achieve that policy goal. So I'm going to begin, and I should say the recommendation urges individual agencies to work with private standards developers and to use technological tools such as read-only access to expand the ready availability of the standards without undermining the copyright and impinging on some other interests that I'll talk about. Now, to begin, just to provide some context, it's really, we have an incredibly extraordinarily significant private standardization system, and it's not actually a new phenomenon. It began in the late 1800s and early 1900s when private standards development organizations emerged to fulfill the standardization needs first of the Industrial Revolution and then later of coming out of the World Wars. And today, the vast majority of technical standards are developed by private sector organizations. And indeed, most of these standards are created for non-regulatory purposes. They're created to allow interoperability and technology, to facilitate trade, to protect health and safety, but really predominantly for private sector purposes. And it really just is massively larger than federal regulation. Just to give you a couple of numbers, there are well over 100 federal agencies, not all of which are regulatory. Compare that to the over 600 standards development organizations that are out there. It's also estimated that there are something like 100,000 active standards in use throughout the United States today. In Professor Mendelson's article, she explains that there are about 9,500 incorporations by reference in the code. That's a number that comes from the Standards Incorporated by Reference database, which is maintained by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, another wonderful component agency of the Department of Commerce. I actually checked it this morning, and that number is now up to 12,043. But that's actually actually an overcounting of the number of standards that are incorporated by reference for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's extremely common for multiple agencies to incorporate by reference the same standard and to do so in multiple provisions. And in addition, it's very common for different agencies and even for the same agency to incorporate by reference different versions of the same standard. So based on these considerations and the analysis I did in the pipeline safety context, I think a good estimate is probably that about 2 to 3% of the standards, the private standards in use out there, are actually made part of federal regulations. We're talking about an incredibly important problem, but viewed in context, it's the tip of a ginormous iceberg. And so any solution that we come up with, I think, to address the public access issue in connection with regulation has to be carefully calibrated not to produce unintended and negative consequences throughout that enormous standardization ecosystem. Now, another point, and I think the next thing I think to acknowledge is that this is not solely a transparency issue or an issue of public access. It absolutely is that, but it's not just that. It's really a multidimensional problem. And one way to sort of explain this is to say that, you know, an agency that is looking to provide free access to its incorporated standards has to find a way to do that that is still consistent with its statutory mandate, allows the agency to do what it needs to do to accomplish what Congress has tasked the agency with doing. It has to refrain from infringing on copyright. And finally, it has to comply with the standards policy as embodied in OMB Circular A119 and as statutorily imposed through the Tech Transfer Act of 1995. So the agencies have a lot of constraints that they're sort of under. Another way to look at this, though, is that each of those constraints really reflects other interests, things that we have to balance sort of against in divining a solution to this public access problem. With respect to statutory mandates, the reality is that oftentimes there is a robust private sector standardization regime that is already in place where an agency is regulating. And oftentimes the purpose of an incorporation is really to allow the agency to make it very clear how that private standardization regime and the federal regulations intersect, preventing an agency from using a standard that is widely in use throughout the industry that they regulate can be counterproductive to important health and safety goals. On the question of copyright, now of course, the reality is that most standard development organizations rely pretty heavily on the revenue from the sale of their standards to fund the standards development process. Obviously, there are problems with that. It imposes public access problems. But it's much easier to identify the problems in the copyright model than it is to identify another better revenue model for the standards developers. So for example, one option would be to charge membership fees or fees to participate in standards development, but then you're going to undermine the progress we've made over the past 4 decades in broadening the base of participation in private standards development. You're going to make it harder for small businesses, for consumer advocates and public interest organizations to participate in standards development. Another alternative is to have the standards developers rely on donations, but that can put them in a very difficult position where they're beholden to large donors who are major players in industry. If they have a separate revenue stream that is usually provided by copyright, when a donor says, we don't like your standard, we're not going to give you money, they can tell them to take a walk. And finally, there's our standards policy, which has really emerged over many decades. And as Nina acknowledges, provides some real benefits to the federal government. And it's not just a question of saving money or making things more efficient. It's also a question of making sure that federal regulations are working with and not against existing private standardization regimes. And in addition, a lot of times the expertise that exists and that an agency really needs to create a standard, the agency may not possess itself. And so it allows them to sort of take advantage of that expertise. So the trick is to find a solution to the public access problem that doesn't sort of undermine any of these other different and yet interrelated concerns and interests. And, you know, Congress actually has recently experimented with a pretty bold public access mandate. In early 2012, they imposed on the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration an absolute prohibition on incorporating by reference into regulations or guidance any document or portion thereof not available to the public free of charge on an internet website. Less than 2 years after that law went into effect, Congress basically gutted it, because the agency, although it was able to make some substantial progress in negotiating free access agreements with its standards developers, there were several standards that it could not get access to that were absolutely essential to its public safety mission. And Congress, recognizing that, significantly softened the requirement. So what is the solution? I'm of the view, and the administrative conference has recommended, that the best approach to this, at least for now and until we know that it will work, is collaboration, to encourage private standards developers, when their standards are incorporated in regulations, to provide free read-only access. It's actually a little easier at the proposed rule stage because you've got a defined period of time, and we've actually seen significant success in agencies getting SDOs to provide access at that stage. But we've also seen incredible strides in standard developers providing free online access, usually read-only, once a regulation has been adopted. The evidence that this can work is the fact that the National Fire Protection Association has been providing free access to all of its codes and standards for well over a decade, and they have still managed to maintain their copyright revenue stream. It's not without its challenges. It turns out that if you're more technologically savvy than me, which is not very, it's very, very easy to break read-only restrictions on documents. And although we usually think of black markets as things that, you know, you get copies of like Louis Vuitton purses off the black market, you don't think of like copies of the National Electric Code. Well, it actually turns out that they've had problems with third parties reproducing copies of the National Electric Code and selling them in violation of the copyright. One of the values of maintaining that copyright is that you preserve the legal ability and the incentive for the standard developer to ensure that only accurate, verified versions of its standards are in circulation, which is really important in this context. In my study of the pipeline regulations, I actually found that 66% of the standards developers had actually agreed to provide free online access independent of Congress's statutory mandate. And the exceptions to that actually seem to be more a problem of standard developers not knowing which standards were incorporated by reference. And I've seen just such an extraordinary shift in the attitudes of standards developers just in the time that I've been working on this issue. When I started in 2011, the idea that anyone would provide free online access was, I mean, people sort of balked at it. Since then, ASTM has created an online library of all of its standards. The American National Standards Institute, ANSI, has created an online portal so that smaller standards developers don't have to create their own infrastructure and instead can use that to provide access. And so I really am, I think, quite optimistic that collaboration can work, and I think we need to give it some time before we sort of throw up our hands and say it's not possible. Sorry, I could talk about this for days. I'll stop. I'll stop now. No, I was right at the end, so.
I want to thank you for letting me participate remotely, particularly to Narayan and Linda. Notwithstanding a variety of technical challenges, I hope you are all able to hear me. I also want to thank the commenters. Emily, of course, I know through her excellent work as a senior counsel at ACUS, and Lois, I was very fortunate to work for years ago when she was the Assistant Attorney General for the Environment Division, and I learned a great deal from her. So thank you to both of you for your comments. I really appreciate it. So with respect to Lois's comments, obviously I'm in agreement, Lois, with everything that you said, and I'm particularly glad that you underscored the need for meaningful public participation in the development of agency rules and the need for a record for that public commenting. That's a critical safeguard as agencies choose which regulations to incorporate. And it's worth underscoring a theme that I think came up in both Emily's and Lois's comments, which is that agencies are there to implement the statutes that Congress passes, whether that's to protect the environment, protect public safety, protect consumers, and the like. Standards development organizations are there to do different things, as Emily underscored. They're there often to set up standards for interoperability. They're there to set up standards to protect safety, but in a private sector sort of way. And so it's particularly critical that we have safeguards to make sure that when agencies choose private rules, in lieu of preparing their own rules, that they do actually carry out the goals that the statutes Congress passed. They do actually protect the public interest in the way that Congress envisioned. And again, that underscores the need for meaningful levels of public access. Let me focus on a couple of things that Emily said in particular. And by the way, Emily, you are absolutely correct that I got interested in this article in the process of ACUS looking at a recommendation on this issue. So ACUS gets credit for that as well. I would like to see us have considerably more assurance of public access than I think ACUS has recommended. And obviously been quite public about that. Emily is certainly correct that these private codes have value. They are often written by experts. They can save agencies substantial resources if agencies decide to go along with a private standard. But we need to be thinking carefully about it. I think what I want to do is start by talking about the example of PHMSA, which Emily referenced. She's correct that PHMSA was asked by Congress to make full online access of standards available to the public if it was going to incorporate them by reference, and so that set PHMSA down a trail of trying to negotiate that access. But I don't think that example, PHMSA was able to negotiate access to 78% of the standards. This is according to Emily's own work, and Emily has done a lot of great work in this area. And PHMSA certainly wanted to take advantage of the expertise in many of these private organizations. But I don't think that means that just because they couldn't get access to a small group of standards, that means we need to give up hope. We just don't know the details of the negotiations between PHMSA and the organizations. And frankly, it's encouraging that 78% of the standards were made available for free by the Standards Development Organization. We don't know if the missing standards perhaps might have been, if the organizations might have agreed to provide access if PHMSA had offered some payment. We don't know that. We don't know if they might have been, if the organizations might have made available the standards, for example, in government depository libraries. What's particularly worrisome, though, is that the agency itself felt that it lacked the expertise to replace the missing standards or even presumably to assess whether those missing standards met the statutory criteria. And that underscores a great concern that if we don't have assurances of meaningful public access, we not only lose the rights to get notice of our obligations, but also our rights, and we lose our opportunity to assure that the agency is actually choosing rules that serve the public interest and properly implementing the statutory commands. Again, as Lois emphasized, these concerns of transparency and public accountability. So to what extent do we need to worry about standards development organizations? I guess I will say I think the burden here is on showing, is on those who want to argue that public access effectively is bad for the public. I think the burden of showing that has to be on those who want to limit public access to show that there truly is no solution to meaningful public access when agencies want to use private standards. And Emily identified some concerns. It might be that some standards development organizations don't want to make standards available for free. That's possible. They do rely on the sale of their standards, although as Emily pointed out, you know, only 2-3% of private standards are actually ever selected by public agencies. It's a fairly small fraction. And it may be that we need some different solutions. Perhaps some payment might be appropriate. Lois talked about the embargo of publication in the scientific data setting. That's a way of assuring some amount of compensation to the private entities that did the work, to be sure. I also want to underscore that the fact that many of the standards development organizations have provided some free reading rooms, it does suggest that private organizations will not refuse to participate in collaborative efforts with agencies to set standards that serve the public interest and that are meaningfully available to the public. Problem with the system that we have, the problem with a truly, a fully collaborative approach in the vein that Emily's discussing, would still leave too much control in the part of the private organizations in terms of when public access is available. So we have these free online reading rooms. Presumably, the private organizations are comfortable with making that level of access available. The problem is, there's several fold problems with our kind of jerry-rigged system that we currently have. First of all, there are some standards that are simply not available for free except if you visit a reading room in Washington, D.C. And that's at the SDO's option, and I think that's not an adequate solution. Second, even when there is some free online access available, the private organization almost always reserves the right to revoke that access at any time and for any reason. Third, lots of standards, even when there is an online reading room, are simply not posted, whether that's an oversight or whether the standard organization has just decided it doesn't want to make that standard available. It's unclear why. Finally, these standards are extremely difficult to locate. They're not centralized. There are some rare exceptions. For example, you can on PHMSA's website click right through to an American Petroleum Institute rule with no problem. But that's rare. Most of these standards are strewn across hundreds of differently organized websites. I can tell you from personal experience, they're quite hard to find. I've been trying since mid-March to get access to the food additive standards for saccharin incorporated by reference by the FDA. The standard they incorporated by reference is out of print. I can't buy it for any price online, and it's going to cost somewhere between $150 and $600 once the private organization gets around to answering my email. That's not adequate public access to our binding law. So, am I talking too long?
No, we'd like to take some comments and questions.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just make a quick final comment on this. As I said in my opening comments, this kind of transparency is critical because legislative actions are some of the most important actions the government takes, and that includes regulatory actions by agencies. People need to know what they need to comply with. They need to know how to make good decisions under the statutory regimes that Congress enacted. And, of course, we need to be able to hold our government accountable for making good decisions that serve the public.
And I know that there are several people in the audience who are with standards organizations, and we want to hear from everyone, and we want anyone to feel free to go up to the microphone and ask questions, but I strongly encourage in particular the people who are here from standards organizations to do so we can hear some of your views on this. And it would be great if people could go to the microphone because we are recording. Okay, if nobody's going to come to the microphone, I know that Mike Vandenberg probably has a question. Who's in this area?
Hi, this is Mike from Nashville. One question I had was, I don't hear anyone quantifying the actual revenue, maybe in more detail, and maybe Emily's got more current figures on that, but how much money are we talking about? Would it be too much for an agency to include in its appropriations request, an amount for paying for private provision of a public requirement? I too was struck by this. I first came across this in private practice, trying to advise a client on how to comply with the innocent purchaser requirements of a site assessment, and realizing my library had to pay ASTM quite a bit of money to get that standard, and it opened my eyes to the idea that there was a private standard that was effectively serving as a public rule. So, but it just raises the question: how much are we talking about? Could we simply substitute, if public disclosure is as important as I think many of us think it is, substitute a federal appropriation for that? If the consensus building process is really important, we can't substitute for that, but we could substitute for the payment.
Do you want to respond first, and then we'll let you
know? So I can't give you figures, but I will say that the answer, unfortunately, is that it varies. the really hard part, if this was like 20 years ago and somebody had noticed this and said, oh, this is a huge emission from the Federal Depository Library System, we should get those things into the Federal Depository Libraries, that would be a much more doable thing. The difficulty is that when you're asking an agency to pay a license for free online access, they're not just providing it for interested members of the public who want to see it because it's part of the law. You're giving it to everybody in the world for free, which means that you potentially have to pay the standards developer basically to fulfill their revenue stream, which, depending on the situation, can be doable or not. The problem, the main holdout in the PHMSA example was actually the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, ASME's boiler and pressure vessel code, which is 30-something volumes. I think it's 30,000-plus pages. It's probably the most expensive standard to produce, and it's used by everyone. I mean, there's not an alternative. Like, PHMSA's not going to come up with an alternative. And the amount of revenue that ASME gets from that is extraordinary. I mean, it basically pays, as I understand it, it's basically like what funds all of their activities, not just the boiler code production. So it's just incredibly challenging. On the other hand, there are opportunities for agencies to do this. So, there, for example, when the Consumer Product Safety Commission used an ASTM standard for toys, they were able to work with ASTM, ASTM was able to work with a guild of small toy manufacturers to work out a licensing arrangement that allowed members of that guild to get copies of the standard for like $10. So there are opportunities to do it. It's just that it's very, very context specific.
I guess which the other part of the question I was going to ask you've now provoked, which is why not ACUS could do this or agencies could do this, provide some standard to separate between those standards where most users probably have the resources and they're a very specialized group versus those where there's a large, more general public type interest.
I must say the idea that the users have the resources is really problematic because it is the rare federal rule that doesn't have a wide range of interests that don't include just a and there's a public interest in being able to look at what the rule is, and there is a researcher interest. We have a lot of academics in this room. My guess is they wouldn't be so keen to be cut out of being able to look at the rule. And so that seems problematic to me. I mean, the idea that you start to see if you can do it collaboratively, I think we would all agree with. It's hard not to agree with that. The question is, let's just say, for the sake of the discussion, that gets you 50%, and then you have 50% more. What do you do with the final 50%? Do you put a deadline? Emily, you suggested that we ought to be using these standards. I don't think any of us suggested we not use them. It's that we are concerned about using private law. And so, you know, at some point you say, if we can't find a way to give the public free access to this, do we then not use it? That's a complicated question. But I do think that it is, to me at least, not a complicated question that we can't have a private system of law in this country that's kind of antithetical to our idea of a rule of law. And that it can mean in the beginning collaboration to kind of figure out ways. And I think that there are lots and lots of journals who would say they're total, they depend on people buying the journal, and yet there is now interest in how good. And I think it's an interest well beyond knowing that public access to research results is really for health issues and quite broad, and the OSTP rules apply to all governments. So people are going to look at and think about ways to do it. I think that the fundamental question is, do we have a commitment to say this is really a public value and or a constitutionally driven right?
Hi, could I add something?
Yes.
Okay, I couldn't hear absolutely everything that Mike said, but I'll take, I could hear Lois and Emily reasonably well. It makes sense to me that agencies should want to respect the value of private standards. The question is, you know, can we afford it? I am exactly in agreement with Lois that we can't compromise on meaningful public access. As to how much it would cost, I want to just mention that Professor Peter Strauss at Columbia has documented that sometimes organizations actually raise their prices of out-of-print standards simply because an agency has chosen to incorporate the standard by reference. And so I think we can't assume that simply because we have a list price of a particular standard, and that represents fair value to the organization, is clearly a subject for further discussion, further investigation, and for negotiation. Professor Lawrence Cunningham has also written an article with some other options here. As to the boiler and pressure vessel code, you know, again, this was the standard that FIMSA had the biggest problem with, and they felt that they needed it. Certainly, it's an important standard to AFNI, but I also want to underscore just how expensive it is to the public to read the sections that FIMSA has incorporated by reference. It is over $2,000 for an individual member of the public to get to see the parts of the boiler and pressure vessel code that that FIMSA thinks are important enough to incorporate by reference in its implementation of the Pipeline Safety Act. And that's just simply not an acceptable outcome. Perhaps congressional appropriations is a solution, perhaps negotiation is a solution, but it has to be fundamental to have meaningful public access.
Just want to be sure I'm in the right place.
Thank you.
Well,